In today's episode of The Daily Brief, I'll talk about two interesting stories. In the first story of the day, I'll talk about the second quarterly results of Reliance and try and summarize the same for you. And in the second story of the day, we'll take a look at the major changes which might come up in the mutual fund industry. Coming to the first story, we'll take a look at how Reliance did this quarter. Now, there are a very few companies in India that touch as many corners of our daily life as Reliance does. From the fuel that powers our cars, to the internet that powers our phones, and from the food in our kitchens to the clothes we wear, Reliance is everywhere. Which is why its quarterly results aren't just about itself. To a degree, it also tells us about how the Indian economy itself is moving. Now, Reliance recently announced its results for the second quarter of financial year 2026. This has been another good quarter for the giant, reporting consolidated revenue of roughly 2.8 lakh crore, which is up by 10% from a year ago. This quarter's profit after tax stood at about 22,092 crore, which is a rise of about 14.3% year on year. But Reliance shouldn't be looked at as a single business. It's a machine made up of many cost of goods sold, each moving with its own rhythm and responding to many different forces. To really understand what's going on, it's looking under the hood to see each cost of goods. With that, let's start with the cost of goods that brings in the lion's share of revenue. The old but critical oil to chemicals, which is the O2C business. Now, this is where crude oil comes in and is turned into everything else like fuel for vehicles or plastics or even the materials for textiles and detergents. Now, the O2C business runs one of the world's largest refineries in Jamnagar, turning it into petrol and diesel that it sells through GOBP stations across India. This quarter, O2C's revenue stood at about 1.6 lakh crore, which was up 3.2% from last year. Its EBITDA, however, grew a whopping 21% as margins on gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel rose sharply. These margins rose because globally, oil supply stayed tight while demand stayed strong. That dynamic actually should tell you the state of global oil trade today, which is buzzing with activity. Now, disruptions at Russian refineries pushed down the world's diesel exports, and China trimmed its own product shipments, and European diesel inventories ran low. Even as crude oil got cheaper, refineries were making more money per barrel of product, lifting margins everywhere. And yet, Reliance benefited much more by playing it smart. Instead of chasing exports, the company channeled more of its fuels into India, where demand was strong and margins were steadier. It could avoid export taxes and cut shipping costs while exposing the company to a market that was still growing fast and was willing to pay more for energy. Its diesel sales were up by 34%, while petrol sales were up by 32%, helped by the GOBP network.
Gas oil cracks up by 37%. That's a large number. And that's because one is the attacks by Ukraine on the Russian refineries, taking them off. Though some of the refineries are coming back quickly also. But the perception in the market is that this is really risky for what's going to happen to the diesel situation. And we have lower inventories in Europe as well as Asia. Gasoline cracks also for this time of the season reasonably good at 8.4, and that's a growth of 24%. That's because again concerns about the refinery outages, and we have lower inventories in Singapore, and exports from China also have moderated. Jet fuel cracks, like I mentioned, it's at pre-COVID levels of almost 8.2 million barrels a day.
Now, Reliance also ran its refinery more efficiently this quarter. It processed a little more crude, which stood at about 20.8 million tons against 20.2 million tons a year ago, by tweaking the mix to get a higher yield of petrol and diesel. Now, here's what the management said.
Now, how did we tap these kind of favorable cracks? We maximized the crude throughput within the same capacity, of course. How we did that was we optimized around blends and different crudes, ensured that always the utilization at the highest level in the crude unit. So instead of having 20.2, we've been able to take the throughput up to 20.8 million tons in that quarter.
Now, the idea here was quite simple. They wanted to turn more of each barrel into the fuels that were making the most money. It also found ways to cut costs of running the refinery by using gas made from refinery waste, as well as buying cheaper power from the power grid.
So we tried to cut the cost of fuel by increasing and maintaining a high level of gasifier operations where the coke is converted into syngas, which is used as a fuel. And also, wherever possible, we've imported cheaper power from the grid. So all these are the activities we've done too.
That said, there were parts of its petrochemicals business that didn't hold up as well. The polyester side of the business, in particular, stayed weak as global textile demand remained soft. But better polymer margins, however, helped make up for the low volumes. All in all, however, O2C is a stable and a mature business. The more interesting business line, however, was retail. Let's take a look at Reliance Retail. Now, this is one of the segments that everybody likes to keep an eye on because of how interesting it is. This quarter, Reliance Retail clocked around 90,000 crore in gross revenue, which was up by 18% year-on-year. Now, the profit after tax came in at around 3,400 crores, which was again up by 17% from last year. It's really hard to appreciate just how massive and sprawling this vertical of Reliance is. For your context, it has 19,000 plus stores across the country. Through these, Reliance sells everything from vegetables to jewelry. And across segments, the company's retail business performed exceptionally well. Its grocery arm grew at about 23% and fashion and lifestyle grew at about 22%, lifted by an early festive season and better footfalls. While electronics jumped 18%, which was helped by the GST rate cut on some appliances and a wave of deferred purchases. Now, much of this serves pent-up demand. Reliance's management says that many customers who had held off big buys in the summer came back for upgrades and new launches once the discounts and festivals began.
Electronics business again had a very, very strong quarter with very, very strong LFL growth. There was some impact in the time period between the announcement of the GST rate reduction on select categories and the actual GST rates came into effect on 22nd September. So during that interim period, people deferred, these are all high ticket purchases, so people deferred their purchases. So there was some impact of sales, but after that, the pent up demand picked up pretty well and that has continued into the festive season.
Now within grocery, Reliance's own label consumer products like Campa Cola and Independence have done an impressive 5,000 crores in gross revenue this quarter. The products benefited from Reliance's own distribution network in JioMart and Kirana partnerships. Now Reliance is also trying out premium formats of grocery stores through the FreshPick brand. At the other end, Reliance is in the process of re-pivoting JioMart into a full quick commerce model. From delivering groceries in an hour or more, the service has been rebuilt for a sub-30-minute delivery. The management called this a structural shift in the grocery model, which is going to be a permanent change in how it fulfills orders.
If you look at that, market has grown substantially. We were a bit late compared to some of our peers in that, but we pivoted our model sometime last year. And once we have kind of pivoted to that model, we had to change our model completely from next day delivery, which was our base model, to, you know, we started with 60 to 90 minute delivery to 30 minute delivery to now significantly lower than 30 minute delivery to match competition.
Now, we wrote in much more detail about the quick commerce side of Reliance's business in our Saturday show, Who Said What? Do check that out. Now, the jewelry business also stood out. See, Reliance reported a steady performance despite skyrocketing gold prices, with the average bill value up 52% year-on-year. This jump wasn't from people buying heavier jewelry, but it was mostly from the price of gold itself. With prices up sharply, the average bill got bigger even though volumes fell, and many customers simply exchanged old gold instead of buying new gold. Now, that surge came from customers trading up to heavier, higher value pieces even as overall volume softened. The company said that its old gold exchange share rose to 32.5% from 21.9% a year ago, which means more shoppers are now swapping older jewelry for new designs.
Another interesting thing which you're seeing is instead of investing more in new gold, the share of exchange has gone up substantially. So it used to be about 22% earlier last year, which has now gone up to almost 33%.
Now let's look at the telecom side. See, Jio Platforms' operating revenue for this quarter came in at about 36,332 crores, which is up by 14.6% year-on-year, while net profit stood at about 7,375 crore, again up by 12.8%. Now, this surge in revenue comes from two factors. Firstly, the company has added about 8.3 million new subscribers this quarter, taking its total base to 506 million. But secondly, each customer is also paying more, as Reliance increased its average revenue per user to about 211 rupees from about 195.1 rupees last year. In return, people are using Jio's network more than ever. Data traffic jumped nearly 30% year-on-year. The per capita data consumption hit 38.7 GB per month, which is the highest in India's telecom market. And this is hardly limited to just urban areas, whereas rural areas' data traffic has grown about 2.2 times year-on-year. But the company is adding a new feather to its cap, with a new AI division called Reliance Intelligence. It'll cater to all things AI and data infrastructure behind it. Reliance is already building huge data centers in Jamnagar, powered entirely by its own green energy. It also aims to develop its own AI products and tools while partnering with OpenAI, Google, and Microsoft. As Reliance Intelligence focuses on creating AI infrastructure, Jio shall act as the face of the business, delivering those AI tools to customers through its huge network. Meanwhile, Reliance Intelligence might also sell its capacity and software both across the group and to outside clients as well. Let's now move to new energy. Now, Reliance has been making giant moves when it comes to renewable energy. In fact, it hopes to make the new energy vertical just as big as the O2C business. And this quarter, we got a glimpse of how serious they are about that goal. At Jamnagar, Reliance is building a solar gigafactory called the Dhirubhai Ambani Green Energy Giga Complex. The factory has already commissioned 4 module lines and its first solar cell line will go live very soon. But that is not the only gigafactory, let alone normal size factory that Reliance is building. It has been moving fast on a gigafactory for battery energy storage systems, which is planned to host about 40 gigawatt hour of power capacity. And that's enough to store several hours of India's daily power demand. And these batteries will feed both grid storage and other renewable projects. And that's not all. 400 kilometers away from Jamnagar in Kutch, Reliance is also developing what could be one of the world's largest clean energy sites, which is a 5.5 lakh acre stretch of desert land that's being cleared for solar and wind installations. The company claims to begin solar power generation from the site in the first half of next year for captive requirements. Now, Reliance is also trying to produce green hydrogen on a commercial scale. We've covered how hard it is to mass produce green hydrogen, in spite of which it hasn't stopped Reliance from trying. In fact, it has also begun pilot production of electrolyzer stacks. Now, these are machines that split water into hydrogen and oxygen. Unlike the other segments of the conglomerate, the new energy business doesn't move the numbers yet. But given the scale of its installations this quarter alone, it's clear that Reliance thinks that the landscape of Indian energy will massively change in the coming years. Now, these are the major engines of Reliance today, which are oil, retail, telecom, and renewable energy. Each of these sit at a different point in its life cycle. O2C is mature and steady, while retail is expanding, and AI and new energy still have a long way to go. And naturally, there's a lot more beneath the surface in a huge business like Reliance. However, with the latest results, what we gather is that they're leveraging their existing strengths and capacity to try and swing big in new and rising sectors. And they're well positioned to ride these winds of change. We're seeing them make early bets in renewable energy, which should power their existing industrial capacity. They also expect AI bets to benefit from their own telecom network. If nothing else, these bets are indeed extremely ambitious, and it'll be really interesting to see how they pan out for Reliance. Now, coming to the second story of the day, see, in a perfect world, mutual funds would be lossless machines for pooling and investing capital. See, you would put your money into the funds pool and all of it would go straight to the markets with no spillage or friction. Every rupee you invest would buy you a claim on the portfolio's assets. Nothing would be lost in between. But the reality is that we don't live in a perfect world. Mutual funds have to pay managers, compliance departments, distributors, brokers, and more. Each of these take a tiny nibble out of your portfolio, and together, these can shave off a good part of returns you get. Now, while some of these costs are sensible, they're the friction inherent to managing and investing large pools of money, and some are not. But to a lay investor, it may not always be clear what these are, let alone if they make sense. And that's why SEBI constantly looks over these funds' shoulders. And recently, the regulator proposed sweeping changes to the mutual fund business, the expenses that funds can change, and what they must tell you. Now, mind you, these are just mere suggestions, and nothing is in place just yet. But they point to how SEBI is thinking and the changes it could bring in soon. Now, there's a lot we haven't been able to cover in this piece. We recommend taking a look at the consultation paper for the whole picture. But we'll cover the changes that matter most to the investors. And let's dive in. Now, there are many changes to the total expense ratio, or the TER. See, every mutual fund scheme charges a small amount, which is a percentage of your holdings, to manage your money for you. Now, some of this stays with the AMC itself as its fee, while some goes out into other expenses that it incurs, like registrar charges or overheads. And collectively, this amount is called the fund's total expense ratio. See, fund houses have some incentive to keep these expenses low. Now, investors compare the expense ratios that different funds charge while considering an investment, which keeps pushing funds to compete on how low they can keep them. At the same time, SEBI polices these charges as well, capping the maximum TER a fund can take. It's here that SEBI proposes the most far-reaching changes. For one, SEBI is asking fund houses to clearly itemize the many extra costs that you might incur, which includes expenses, brokerage, exchange fees, and so on. Up until now, investors would just be given a partial figure at the outset, with other costs coming in as a surprise. And these changes, however, could bring in a lot more clarity. But beyond that, there are more significant tweaks in the works. Now, there are some expenses that fund houses have no control over. Now, these charges go directly to the government through taxes and levies, like GST payments and securities transaction taxes, which is also known as the STT. And naturally, clubbing these under a fund's TER makes little sense. The whole idea of a TER cap is to stop AMCs from overcharging investors and not to limit what a government can tax. If a big part of that expense is a statutory payment, it confuses a lot of things. Now, let's suppose the government raises STT. Under the old rules, funds had to absorb the extra tax within the same cap, even though the AMC earned no more. And if the government cut STT, there was no clear way to pass savings back to investors. Now, SEBI sort of acknowledges this issue already. The GST payable on fund management fees, for instance, already lies outside the cap. All statutory levies, though, are still inside the cap. But now, SEBI wants to take the next logical step by keeping the statutory levels outside the TER cap. If the proposals go through, investors will soon have a clear idea of what expenses the fund house is actually charging and what gets paid out to the government. However, this exclusion doesn't mean that fund houses will get to charge higher expenses. To keep things fair, SEBI also plans to reduce the expense ratio cap slightly. Now, as an investor, going ahead, you should expect to pay roughly the same amount, but you'll also know better where your money is really going. But perhaps the most significant change for the industry, however, has to do with brokerage fees, which are charged over and above these expense ratios. And the scope of those fees is soon slated to come down. Let's break this down. Whenever a mutual fund buys or sells a stock, it has to pay a small percentage of this transaction value as a brokerage fee to the broker that actually executes this trade. The fund passes on this cost to investors. Under SEBI's current rules, mutual funds can charge up to a 0.12% of every cash market trade and about 0.05% of every derivatives trades to investors over and above the scheme's TER. While studying these, however, SEBI found out something odd. Somehow, different sorts of funds were paying wildly different brokerage rates, even though they all had access to institutional brokerage rates. Take arbitrage funds that track the prices of same instruments in different markets, say between different exchanges or between the spot and futures markets. When they spot a difference, they mechanically buy it for cheap and sell it higher. These funds were making transactions in bulk, and for those, they were paying brokerages of about barely 0.01 to 0.013%. Other equity funds, meanwhile, were paying 5 to 10 times as much, which was about 0.05 to 0.12%. Now, why this difference? After all, executing a trade took the same amount of money, no matter what your strategy was. And SEBI figured that those funds weren't actually paying to just have their trades executed. They were also paying for all the add-on services that their brokers bundled in, like research reports or analysis. Now, that's hardly fair for an investor. After all, why you pay an active manager their fee is precisely because they're supposed to do all that analysis for you. If the same fund pays a broker for that research and passes those costs to you, they're basically charging you twice for the same service. And because of which, SEBI proposes to slash the cap on brokerage fees considerably from 0.12% to 0.02% for equity and from 0.05% to 0.01% for derivatives. These are the only brokerage costs a fund house is allowed to pass to an investor over and above its own expenses. Now, this proposal doesn't mean that a fund can pay a broker higher rates, but if it does, any additional amount it charges will come under its TER caps. Those extra charges won't be counted as brokerage. For all intents and purposes, brokerage fees will now be limited to not more than execution costs. Expect this to hit the bottom lines of brokers with margin institutional businesses, since every extra rupee above those lower caps will directly eat into their own fee pool, that fund houses are likely to press brokerages for better rates. And unless brokerages offer exceptional research, their add-ons might cease to a major source of revenue. With all these SEBI-mandated caps on fees, you might wonder, what if there's a fund house that can legitimately command a bigger fee? And what if it has higher expenses, but those translate into bigger returns? Should they not be compensated fairly? Right now, SEBI controls what a fund can charge through a fixed cap. No matter how a fund performs, its manager earns the same fee within the cap. But now, SEBI has proposed a different expense ratio, which will work like a performance-linked fee. See, this isn't mandatory though. A fund can still stick to the old system, but it can also choose to change investors depending on how well it performs. Now, this could align the fund's incentives to those of the investor. If a fund thinks that it can beat the expense caps that SEBI proposes, it simply has to beat the benchmark. And if it succeeds, it gets to charge a bit more. But doing so entails risks. If you do worse, you'll have to be content with lower fees. That said, this is a tricky system to pull off. What benchmarks should one use to measure outperformance? Countries that use similar systems, like the US, have found out that success of these systems depends heavily on the specifics. If your benchmark is too low, investors might pay extra for nothing. And if it's too high, fund managers may take outsized risks while chasing those benchmarks. The benchmarks need to be just right. For now, this proposal is best read as SEBI testing the waters. It hasn't yet fleshed out the details. Those will be finalized in a later consultation. On top of their normal expenses, many mutual funds also charge an exit load. If you exit too early, you might have to pay the AMC a small penalty, like about 1%, in order to compensate them. Now, before 2012, the AMC would pocket all of this money. Some of it would be used to offset all these commissions and marketing costs that it spent on you, but much of it would simply go to the fund house. In effect, it turned early exits into a revenue stream. While it arguably made sense to penalize investors for too quick an exit, it created weird incentives as well. Fund houses would then want to push people out too early. Which is why SEBI decided to correct this by saying that if a fund charged an exit load, it had to use it to reward others for staying with the fund. The fund itself couldn't pocket exit loads anymore. But there was one exception to this rule. If you left early, the funds would be left short of marketing costs and commissions it incurred on your account. And because of which, funds were allowed to take an additional amount, which is an extra 20 basis points, to meet these expenses. Now, this was always meant to be a transitory provision. In 2018, SEBI clipped this add-on down from 20 basis points to 5 basis points. But now, it plans to remove that add-on amount completely. To make fund houses whole, it might permit such funds to revise their TERs upwards by 5 basis points. Now, on the surface, SEBI's proposals might seem like small tweaks to the plumbing of the mutual fund business, which they are. After all, changes of a fraction of a percentage here and there. But together, these could rewire large parts of the industry and push it to rethink every rupee that it charges. And to a great extent, the regulator is trying to get there by pushing for much more transparency. It wants investors to be able to see, line by line, where exactly their money is going and to whom it's going. And that visibility in itself could reshape how this industry behaves. Now, moving on to the tidbits. The first tidbit, India's industrial output rose by 4% year-on-year in September, which was led by strong manufacturing and capital goods. Consumer durables jumped 10.2%, while mining slipped slightly. Growth for April to September stood at about 3%, showing steady industrial recovery despite uneven sectoral performance. Coming to the second tidbit, now L&T is exploring entry into the electronics manufacturing services, which is also known as the EMS sector, with talks for a 200-acre facility near Chennai. The $17 billion group aims to build end-to-end capabilities, focusing on industrial, defense, and aerospace electronics, which is similar to Tata's integrated manufacturing model. Now, coming to the third tidbit, Bira 91's main backer Kirin Holdings and lender Anicut Capital have taken control of the Beer Cafe, citing Bira's worsening cash crunch and losses. B9 Beverages, which is Bira's patent, reported a 748 crore rupees in losses in financial year 24 and faces a mounting debt. The move is meant to protect Beer Cafe assets as Bira contests the action in court. That's all the news I have for you today. See you in the next one.